Angie's List is now Angie, the nation's largest home services marketplace. And Angie is here to help homeowners get all their jobs done well. Angie has helped over 150 million homeowners care for their homes. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, come to Angie to connect with and hire skilled professionals to get the job done well. My son needed a major yard cleanup at his new home. We went straight to the Angie website and found a bunch of local, reliable, and affordable pros to handle the job, and one did pronto. Angie can help you find the best price for your project. Angie lets you request and compare quotes from multiple pros in just a few taps, or book services at an upfront price based on local data. Angie has cost guides that tell you what others have paid for similar projects, both nationally and in your area. Get started at Angie.com. That's ANGI.com, or download the app today. The app and website are free to use. Ladies, hello, gentlemen. This is the Victor Davis Hanson Show. I'm Jack Fowler, the host, the star, the namesake. That is Victor Davis Hanson. He is the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and the Wayne and Marsha Buskey Distinguished Fellow in History at Hillsdale College. Victor lives officially on the internet at the Blade of Perseus. Its address is victorhanson.com. I'll tell you more about that later and why you should be subscribing. Victor is a best-selling author, syndicated columnist, farmer, military historian, classicist. He's everything. A great guy too. And we're going to talk today, Victor, get your thoughts about, oh my gosh, let's see, the new issue of Strategica, which is what you published for the aforementioned, or you oversee, I should say, for the aforementioned Hoover Institution. We have a number of important stories relating to ongoing, continuing, increasing anti-Semitism on American college campuses. John Kerry, another plastic surgery octogenarian at the higher ranks of this government, is saying stupid things. No surprise there. But we're going to begin the show by getting your thoughts about a Veterans Administration bureaucrat with an idiotic decision. And we'll get to that, Victor, right after these important messages.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We are back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor, I don't know that we should hang on this all so much, but I just really, really wanted to get your thoughts. I'm sure our listeners do also. Headline is VA official who tried to ban iconic World War II kissing photo has controversial history. Mm. Her name is the Assistant Undersecretary for Health, Rima Ann Nelson. And Victor, I think you could even be, a 12-year-old kid in America who probably never heard of World War II, but might have actually seen one of the most famous photographs ever taken, celebration of VJ Day in Times Square in 1945 of a sailor kissing a nurse. Just an iconic photo. And this was offensive to the Biden administration flunky here. And she ordered that this image, which is found in many a VA facility or hospital, that it be removed from the walls because it did not fit the department's no tolerance policy towards sexual harassment and assault.
How do they know it was not consensual?
Yeah, could have been. She could have been trans too. You never know. It could have actually been.
This is really, there's so many subtext to this whole story. Number one is we live in a society where young women are dressed more provocatively than even in the 1960s. The 1960s look was baggy pants, you know, with holes in them and sloppy tops and no perfume or patchouli oil and no, this is different. You go onto the websites and women are, you know, look at the Kardashian model. So we are the most prudish Victorian and the most exhibitionary society at the same time. So then she wants to go back into the past and then construct this idea that this brave soldier or sailor after the war is over, then what, walk down and sexually attacked a woman by kissing her who didn't seem to be too upset about it. And if you look at the actual moving pictures of what was going on in New York, it was, or what went on in Europe when women were liberated, women often approach men to kiss them, and for good reason, that they were free and they appreciated the males had done, not all, but the majority of the hard work to free them. That's one subtext. Second subtext is the left doesn't like World War II, Jack. They really don't. They don't talk about it very much. And the reason that they don't talk about it is, first of all, if they do talk about it, it's only really on three topics. Number one is Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Right. Number two is the Japanese internment. And number three is the Soviet Union did all the work. That's pretty much where they are. But they don't like the idea that a 90% white country went out and won the war because there was apartheid in the sense that black soldiers were not allowed to fully participate in the war, although many did very heroically, that, you know, in, especially in Italy, with the Tuskegee Airmen and other people. But the point is they don't like World War II. It was an unequivocal American win. Things were simpler. That was the greatest generation. They don't buy into any of that. The other thing is people should realize that DEI is not just an act of commission that's dangerous. So this was stupid to try to destroy an iconic picture. But that also reflects an act of omission. Part of the reason that we have DEI is people are incompetent, or they're not willing, or they're not able to do what they're supposed to do, like be professors or teachers, teach math or science or history. So we have imported a lot of people to police faculty, police curricula, police foundations, police corporations, police facilities. So we're spending a lot of time with incompetence like this that have nothing other that to do than go through and try to find an iconic picture and then get some headlines as if she's a custodian of contemporary moral justice. But most of, and you pointed that out, many of the VAs that she's been in charge of have been despicable in their records of treatment toward veterans. And the entire VA system has endemic, systemic problems about providing care to veterans and wounded people. Right. And the last thing they need to do is divert from that mission to go into the superfluous. But, you know, we talked about that before. I wrote a column about the misdemeanor and the felony that, and I talked about Michael Bloomberg, that historic snowfall when he was mayor and they just were paralyzed. They could not clean the streets of snow in New York. And right. He was talking about supersized soft drinks and how we had to ban them. And what I'm getting at is the left always ignores the existential. that they can't handle, like homelessness. But then they go homelessness or the border or violence, rising crime. So they think, well, we have to do something. So let's do something irrelevant. Let's talk about supersizing ranks or pronouns or something that has it's of no interest. And whenever you see that, it's always an indication that something existential and pressing is there, either clueless about solving that problem or they cause the problem and don't want it solved.
Well, Victor, there's an interesting related item on that line of thought has to do with J.K. Rowling, from the famous Harry Potter author, and not a conservative. And I want to raise this in a second. But first, I just want to take a moment, Victor, to introduce our sponsor, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. Nope, they have new aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can, 1, cut or even eliminate interest. 2, find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. And 3, stop those threatening phone calls. Without bankruptcy and without a loan, the bottom line is they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's ZAPMYDEBT. Zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com. And we do thank Pivotal Debt Solutions for sponsoring the Victor Davis Hanson Show. So, Victor, to further torture our listeners to the sound of my voice, I have to read these. This is from an article the other day. The headline was J.K. Rowling tortures trans broadcaster who reported her for a hate crime. So get this. Harry Potter author gave a scathing response to a transgender broadcaster who reported her to law enforcement for committing a hate crime, which is misgendering. English broadcaster India Willoughby, who identifies as a transgender woman, accused the famous author of violating discrimination laws by calling Willoughby a man. He goes on to say, said Rowling is in breach of both the Equalities Act and the Gender Recognition Act. So Rowling replied, quote, "Aware as I am that it's an offense to lie to law enforcement, I'll simply have to explain to the police that, in my view, India is a classic example of the male narcissist who lives in a state of perpetual rage that he can't compel women to take him at his own valuation." I think it's a great line, Victor, but also implicit to all what this India Willoughby did, kind of getting along what we were talking about, is the desire to criminalize you for not genuflecting before these the new ideology. So anyway, Victor, your thoughts on J.K. Rowling, what she's doing here, and then we can move on to
something. Yeah, I applaud her efforts, and she's got the financial independence and influence to be very effective. So basically, she's saying, say what you want, I could care less. She's kind of like an Elon Musk. All these people that do that, we should all support, because they have the power and the influence and the courage to stand up to these people. What is all this about? I mean, what is the whole transgender, you have to get my pronouns right? What is capitalizing the B in black? What is the DEI, what is all the, it's just a 360 degree 24/7 assault on what we would call traditional American values and what the United States became, by people who are very angry at it, but not angry enough to disengage from it. In other words, they understand that it's the wealthiest, the freest, the fairest, or at least was until recently, country, and that's for a reason, and that reason bothers them, because they understand when they take control and they put their socialist and often tribalist protocols into policy, the whole thing starts to blow up, and it when I say blow up, it starts to resemble Mexico or Venezuela or Uganda or Thailand. It looks like the world everywhere else but the United States, and maybe some places in Europe. So they're not stupid. And this is the greatest problem the left has. They cannot explain, once they open the border and they welcome 8 to 10 million people, why they don't come. If Venezuela opens her border and says, we want 8 to 10 people, they won't come. If Haiti says that, they won't come. Canada, probably they won't come. So, but they can't explain what it is about the United States that people vote with their feet and we want to join it. Or they can't explain their own wealth. They can't explain it. They can't explain an Oprah Winfrey or a LeBron James or the Obamas. They just can't. Because according to, and they can't explain why 20% of the population of Israel is better off than Arabs in any other country, maybe except for oil-fed Gulf sheikdoms. They can't explain why Israeli Arabs don't say, I want to show solidarity with the PLA and Hamas, and I'm moving out of this horrible Zionist entity. They can't explain that. And that's what's so strange about it. They understand that the system works to their benefit. So they just like little, I don't know what you would call them, rodents or squirrels. They nibble things around the edges, like pronouns or racist or capitalizing this word, or you can't use illegal. But and then they blast the system, but they understand that the system is in their interest,
right?
Because it's not their system and they don't have control. And every once in a while in history, they take over. You have to, I'm not saying they can't take over. People do things that are not in their interest. So we know what happens when they took over China. We knew what happened. They took over North Korea, Cuba, Russia. They destroy things and kill a lot of people. But usually they're content just to, I don't know, bother us on their periphery. This is different. This is not the Clinton administration. And this is not the Johnson administration. This is not the Carter administration. Not even the Obama administration. This administration is a full-fledged Jacobin, hard-left revolutionary effort. And they want to fundamentally change things. And they will do great damage to the system. But usually it's just, I'm going to ankle bite you until I get my way. Or you have to give $500 million of your capitalist dirty money for illegal alien health care, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, Victor, there's a lot of madness going on campuses in America today, directed at Jewish students, Israel. We've got at least three worthwhile stories to get your thoughts on, and we'll get those right after these important messages.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We're back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. So, Victor, if you don't mind, I'd like to just pull these up one at a time. One has to do with a professor at the UC Berkeley who's leading a protest. Another has to do with a professor at Columbia University in New York who's now become the target of that college because he's spoken out against what happened to Jews on October 7th. And the third story has to do with MIT, Massachusetts Institute Institute of Technology, and anti-Semitism, and it's being recalcitrant in providing documents to a congressional investigation of what the hell's going on that campus. So, but we could start up at Berkeley, if you will, Victor. There's a professor there, Ron Hassner, and he's at the law school, and he is fighting back. So it's kind of, you know, you talked about J.K. Rowling. We talked about her, and she has at least the means to do something to protect herself in some way from any real retribution. But it's nice when they're when other people who are not billionaires fight back in their ways. And this is one such example, I think. So Professor Hassner has started I'm going to just read this very quickly. He wrote to the students at the school this past week. "I've hatched a strange plan. I am launching a sit-in protest against anti-Semitism and for student safety in my office starting today, Thursday, March 7th at 6 p.m. If my students feel they cannot walk safely across campus without being bullied, then I will not cross campus either. I'll be conducting all my classes via Zoom from now on. I've invited my colleagues to do likewise. I will stay in my office until we take necessary steps to prevent violence between students. I will teach, eat, and sleep in my office." And he goes on. I think, well, you know, what can one man do who's sick and tired of seeing Jews on that campus be bullied, intimidated, etc.? So I applaud him.
I do too. He's going to be there a long time because administration is not going to do anything. Everybody should remember how the academic mind works. It's essentially a timid mind that has sought retreat on these enclaves where the rules of the world don't apply and they're protected by things like quote unquote academic freedom, tenure, etc. But what we're seeing is a very predictable historical cycle. Usually anti-Semitism goes in three stages. People individually start to go after Jews for a variety of reasons. Usually it's jealousy, envy, anger, personal failure. But then in section two, step two, people start to complain, and the state then is aware of it, but the state either doesn't do anything or encourages it. And then step three, if one and two transpire, then step three is the state then fuses with the anti-Semitic elements, and they use state policy to hound, kill, go after Jews. We're now going into phase two. We know all of these things are happening. We know that MIT, for example, and Berkeley have had this whole history of anti-Semitism that came overt after October 7th, and we know they're not doing anything about it. Berkeley just had a protest where an IDF lecturer just couldn't speak. They stormed everything. They didn't do anything to them because they support it. And so this professor is starting to look around and saying, where's the administrative support? Why isn't anti-Semitism in the same category as racism or Islamophobia or whatever we call it? It's not. These people do not like Jews. And there's 250,000 of these Middle East students, most of them non-U.S. citizens in our university. They pay the entire tuition. There's no discounts. It's all oil fed, our state money. They come over here. They're a powerful block. Under the last 3 years of admissions, if you look at so-called oppressed groups, it's about 80% of the student bodies. And white males are about 9% and most of them are left wing. So my point is that an administrator looks at what's going on in the campus and he puts his finger in. He wets his tip of his finger and he says, where does the wind of influence and power blow? If I stick up for these Jews, and by the way, this is sort of like the 1920s, 30s quotas against Jews. They're conveniently put into the white male category. And when you take out the SAT and the comparative ranking of high schools to quantify the value of a 4.0, they're not going to get any benefit at all. So there's far fewer Jews on campus. So this administrator, this college president, this dean says to himself, where is the power coming from? Is it coming from the Jewish group? No. It's coming from the people who can get me fired. And what does he mean by that, Jack? He means if Jewish students protest, they hand out leaflets. They bring in speakers. They are polite. They say hello to the policeman. If Palestinian, Hamas, radical Muslim students protest, they chase Jews into libraries. They throw red paint on the Lincoln Memorial. They deface the walls to the White House. They shut down the Golden Gate. They shut down the Manhattan Bridge. They'll even storm Arlington. They'll even go into the National Cemetery on Wilshire Boulevard in New York. They'll do anything. They'll knock a person over and kill him if they have to. And they know they're not going to be charged. So in the college president or administrator's mind, they think, I go against the Jews and don't do anything when they're harassed. No, but there's no problem. Maybe I'll get a few less donations, but I still got a $30 billion endowment. I go against the Hamas people. They're going to be in my office. They're going to follow me home. They're going to go to my house. They might even go to my, if I'm Jewish, they might go to my synagogue. And so they're now mainstreaming that. And the next phase, if it doesn't stop, the next phase is the state will start to intervene against Jews. And I expect that to happen. I really do. So these incidents, I expect people to go after Jewish. And they, I mean, when you say, well, Victor, what are they do? They will say this Jewish student is engaging in hate speech. He's he's guilty of Islamophobia. He is violent. They'll do anything, but they will start to go on the side against Jews in the third phase. Yeah. And after that, it's pretty scary.
Well, a precursor of that on the administrative level, Victor, is exactly what you were talking about. Is that's the Columbia University situation where this professor, Shai Davidi, we talked about him a few weeks ago because he wrote a piece for the Tablet magazine. He's a real lefty, and so is his wife. And all their friends were lefties. But when October 7th happened, he's Jewish and he's an Israeli citizen also. He said, this is terrible. My people are getting murdered here and raped, and this is outrageous, and we need to condemn this. And he immediately he dropped by his friends, ostracized. So he wrote about it. I recommend our listeners go to Tablet Magazine online and look him up, Shai Davidi. And he says, we've come to the conclusion, even though I'm a progressive left, the problem is I'm a Jew. And that really is intolerable to many people on this side of the ledger. So right now he protested. Online, and he wrote that piece, and Columbia University is going after him. They're now investigating him for acts on social media, whatever the hell that might mean. This is another case of someone, even though he's from the left, he's standing up and he's fighting in his way, and he's paying a price for it. But they need the attention of this, and they need our support anyway. Any thoughts on that, Victor? Then we go on MIT. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, well, the president's doing nothing at Columbia. They never do, and they're under intense scrutiny by Congress, and they're still doing nothing. And these universities think they're morally superior to everyone else, so they're always resisting subpoenas in a way that they would put anybody else in jail who did if they had their druthers. If you remember, one of the terrible three that were testifying, Claudine Gay is now gone, and Liz McGill is gone, but not, I think her name was Sally Kornbluth.
Sally Kornbluth at MIT.
Yes. I think she's Jewish, too.
She is.
And she's the president of MIT. And when it came up that MIT students were harassing Jews physically and making it dangerous for them to go to certain places, she said, in effect, that she couldn't really punish them or enforce existing rules because to do so might find some of the Middle East students guilty. And if they were guilty of violating school laws or statutes, they might lose their Visa card. If they lost their Visa card, they might be deported. And that would be unfair. So it's better for them to harass Jews with impunity than to hold them to account, give them a record, and have them go back to the beloved Middle East, which they all praise ad nauseum. So that's the decision that she's made. And she should have been fired because she said exactly what the other two did.
Right.
That she couldn't act because of free speech considerations, when we all know that they act all the time to suppress any speech that they don't find left wing. And so what my point is, she and I don't know what the guy's name at Columbia Petro or something, they all think they can finesse this, that the power comes from the Middle East students. And what they're really hoping for, I believe this, is a Trump presidency, because it'll do two things. It will deport all of these students who are breaking the law, and they won't have to deal with them anymore. But it'll give them a wonderful platform to say, not in my name, you don't. You can't deport Middle Easterns. This is Islamic phobia. This is horrible. This Trump, this is what I expect of Trump. And then privately, oh my God, thank you. And so I think they're all waiting for a Trump presidency and have that travel ban where he just says, if you're from 8 or 9 countries that are unstable and we can't authenticate or adjudicate who comes in, and he'll pick some so they're not just all Muslim, as he did last time, Iran, North Korea, I would add certain other countries I won't mention, but a lot of Algeria, maybe the West Bank, Gaza, Lebanon, Syria, just nobody comes in from those countries. These presidents will be very happy.
Yeah. Here's about the MIT thing, and there's Congresswoman Virginia Fox, excuse me, from North Carolina. She's running that House Education and Workforce Committee, or it's a subcommittee. She's the one that's requested records from MIT that they have been, as you mentioned, Victor, they have not been providing. But a little story about this, and it says about what's happening on that campus. On November 9th, the anniversary of Kristallnacht, the Coalition Against Apartheid blocked students from attending classes. MIT's response was to warn Jewish students to avoid engaging the protesters for the sake of their own, quote, physical safety and well-being, end quote, the letter also said. We can imagine many other comparisons, but imagine it was a historically black college, and it's Black History Month, and some white group does something on campus, and the black students there are told, well, just avoid them, you know, for your own safety. It would be intolerable. But here at one of the great elite colleges,
I know. I don't think they're one of the great elite anymore. I think what's happening, we're in a revolutionary flux, and we can't really adjudicate the speed or the volume of it because we're right in the middle of it. But the outsiders can. And I think what we're watching is drip by drip by drip, Stanford, Columbia, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Duke, MIT. These universities are doing two things. They're offending the public, because all the public is reading about is how they've greenlighted anti-Semitism, racism, separate dorms. They shout down speakers. There's nothing good that comes out of it. And then when you look at their admissions policies, getting rid of the SAT, using racial quotas, they're offending a lot of upper middle class Asian and white liberals whose kids cannot get into these schools because of the wrong color. And they're victims of racial discrimination. But more importantly, we're now getting into the fourth year of this. And these universities have student bodies that would not have been admitted, not to Victor's admissions, not to Jack's admissions policies, but to their admissions policy, say, circa 2018. So basically, they've said, well, we took 100 years to establish these tough policies, high SAT, high perfect GPA, you have to play an instrument, or you had to be you know, something, Eagle Scout at 15 or so. This is what we said. And we said that because we have a curriculum that is so demanding. And we're in competition to get the best talent in the world so that when you graduate from this place, this is not the 1930s Gentleman C. Princeton School. This is not the 1680, 1720 Harvard Churchy School. This is a world-class research. We are training the best and the bright. And then all of a sudden they say in 2021, sorry, that was a big lie. We didn't need to do that. All we have to do is let people in without the SAT. We're not going to look whether Selma High School out there where Victor lives has the same standards as Lowell High School in San Francisco. No, no, no. We're going to let in anybody that has maybe a minus average from any high school. As far as that third category, just write Black Lives Matter 100 times and you'll get into Stanford. So that's what they've done. Yeah. On the front end, and now it's been in their third year, and you talk to faculty, and I do all the time. And I know I keep beating that dead horse, but it's new courses, water down existing courses, inflate the grades. And the result is when you see these kids, and I've talked to some of them, when they graduate from Columbia Journalism School, when they come out of Yale Law School, when they come out of Stanford, they don't know anything. And everybody knows that. So that is a ticking time bomb. These universities, if they don't pivot immediately, are destroying their reputations. And you talk to so many parents, and they're saying to themselves, it's kind of good my kid didn't get into Stanford, because now I see that he would be indoctrinated, number one, and he'd get a crappy education. If I can get him into St. Thomas Aquinas or Hillsdale, or maybe, I don't know, Michigan State or the University of Tennessee, I'll just do that. It'll be actually a much better curriculum, and he'll come out educated. But these other places, they have the name. I know that, but the name won't be worth anything in 4 years. It's not worth anything now. If I see a student that graduated with my degree from these places, I just assume they cannot read Latin or Greek, because they can't. I would not expect them, you know, to give them an op-ed in the San Francisco Chronicle and say translate like we had to do. I don't think they could do that into Latin or Greek. I think if I asked them to do an apparatus criticus of a text, they couldn't do it. Maybe I don't know anything about the rhetoric of transgenderhood in a sanctuary in Sicily. But that's pretty irrelevant. That's what they're studying. And that's across the board in literature and history. And they're destroying their brand. It's kind of like Bud Light or Target or Disney. Universities are like Disney right now. And Disney didn't know what it was doing because everybody was praising it in the media. Then all of a sudden they woke up and said, nobody's watching these stupid movies we're making. Mm-hmm. Nobody really wants to come here and see a bunch of transgendered animals come over and pet us. We don't want any of this stuff. And that's happening with the universities. It's slow right now, and we're in the middle of it, and we can't fully appreciate it, but it's happening.
Yeah.
And these universities are destroying their reputations it took over a century to create. And we'll see which one stops it first. Mark my words, I mean, I know Dartmouth got the SAT back, but they will bring the SAT back, or they will perish. They will bring the SAT back, and they will start going back to proportional representation. That means that if you're Black, you'll have 12%. If you're Latino, you'll have 13%. If you're Asian, you'll have 16%. If you're white, you'll have 67% or something. And they'll have to do that. And they won't even look at race in the way that they do now. But if they don't, it's going to be... Another thing they've done, and nobody talks about this, but I go to a lot of campuses. We're now into about 4 years of hiring, DEI hiring. And we're in about 10 years of radical proportional representation and repertory hiring as well. And you're starting to see in these universities that the older faculty, 40 and above, are mostly white, Asian. They're all left. So I'm not talking about ideology. I mentioned online with, I think it was Sammy's show, that I think there were 14 Trump voters among the campus housing in our zip code. 14 voted in the primary for Trump, 550 for Biden. But so there are no Republicans or conservatives on campus, but you're starting to see that the younger faculty are DEI faculty, and they don't like the older faculty. And the older faculty are shocked that they've said, wow, we created this Frankensteinian monster.
Right.
And rather than praising us for giving it life, it wants to devour us. So I just think the university's got so many problems, it's not going to make it, at least as it is now.
On the expensive side, and from the perspective of the parent who was, let's say you're at that kind of unfortunate zone where you're making a decent income, and that means you've got to pay full fare, and full fare for 4 years now at a private college is pushing $300,000. Think of how many years you have to work to have that amount of disposable income to pay for your kids' education so they can be turned into a communist. You know, it's got to be.
It's scary, too. I mean, I'm not going to, I won't give any of the information, but I had a problem with something I've had for a while called mastocytosis. It's very fully controlled, but when you go in and some of the manifestations of it, you can develop an allergy, lethal allergy to a bee. So if I go into a particular hospital, I see a particular doctor and he asks me, do you have any problems besides this newfound allergy that we're pumping you through with drugs? And I say this, and the doctor never heard of it. That's kind of scary, right?
Yeah.
And I can replicate those stories with other physicians that I've gone to. And so if you want to do this, America, and you want to, for there's arguments for it, that underserved communities feel better with doctors from their own communities. But if they're not held to the exact same standard as everybody else, then you're going to unwind. The same thing is, you know, the other day there was the first two Black women pilots, and there was a big, United had a big announcement that this is the first time that every single person in the plane is Black, all the crew and both pilots. And that's nice, but that's not what the 300 passengers, I think it was 770, what they want to hear is that we have people who have the highest record of excellence in among the United pilots in general, and are their races irrelevant? That's all that matters. Their race is the degree to which their training shows that they were the top pilots.
About the mechanics? The wheel's going to fall off and door fly open, right?
Well, a wheel just fell off, as you saw, a United wheel. How can a mechanic put a wheel on and fall off? I mean, Victor is pretty on mechanical, I suppose, but I put tractor wheels on, I put car wheels on, I have put four-wheeler wheels on, I put riding lawnmower wheels on. Guess what, Jack? None has ever fallen off. How hard is that to do?
Hard landing.
One bad mechanic can kill a lot of people.
Okay, yeah. Well, Victor, we're going to talk about, I'll get your thoughts on a well-known, I'm sorry, jerk, John Kerry. We'll get to that right after these important messages.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car-selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
We are back with the Victor Davis Hanson Show. This episode, we're recording on the 9th, Saturday, the 9th of March, and this particular episode is up on Thursday, March 14th, which will be the eve of the Ides of March. So what? It's just another day. St. Patrick's Day is also straight ahead, Victor. Here's a headline. John Kerry, Russia and Ukraine. This may be the dumbest thing John Kerry has ever said. This is a piece. I forget who wrote this for National Review. And I know I began the show, said he's another. I love octogenarians, but he is one, just like the president. And they both clearly have had a lot of plastic surgery. So I just want to get that in. Here's the story says, here's what Kerry said the other day. Now, he's leaving his climate czar position to go work on the Biden reelection campaign. If Russia wanted to show good faith, they could go out and announce what their reductions are going to be and make a greater effort to reduce emissions now, Kerry said during a foreign press briefing this past week. Maybe that would open the door for people to feel better about what Russia is choosing to do at this point of time.
Oh, wow. That don't give Putin any ideas, John. What Putin might be doing next week is he's going to get all of his generals together and he's going to say, listen, we're going to put the fear of God in the Ukrainians. We're going to have a lightning raid and we're going to kill all of our prisoners and we're going to take 100 missiles and deliberately try to blow up as many high rises. But we're going to tell everybody that they are fueled with biofuels. Biofuels, and we're going to say that our uniforms are recyclable, and we have a special unit that recycles all of our plastic cups, right. and then we get to kill like monsters that we are. We just do it, and yeah, that's what he's talking about. Yeah. John Kerry is an idiot. I thought he retired from his climate change czardom. I think he did, or he was.
Well, he's transitioning from there to Biden's
it's funny
re-election.
It's funny that how the Democratic candidate in 2000 and the Democratic candidate in 2004 became fanatics on this topic, Al Gore and John Kerry, just fanatical.
And well, he probably made a ton of money off of it.
Well, we know Al Gore is a near billionaire. He did, but yeah. It doesn't matter with John Kerry because he married a
married one, right? Yeah,
and he inherited. His wife was a widow, so he inherited the Heinz ketchup fortune.
Yeah,
and he's always done that. He married a multimillionaire the first time who passed away. He's always married somebody who's very wealthy that took care of him in the style that he deserves. And I say deserves without being mean, because he was asked particularly, did he think his private, 5 gallons of high-priced carbon-laden aviation fuel per minute per engine was wasteful, given the alternative of first-class air travel to his various climate change meetings? He said, I have to be effective. The quicker I get there, the more effective and dynamic. So, yes, I don't like doing it, but I have to. You know, the means are necessary because the end justifies them. And that's how he justified flying private, why he would yell and scream about getting rid of private jets.
Did you ever meet that John O'Neill who ran the Swift Boat Vets group?
Yeah, I did. I had dinner with him once at a Renaissance Horowitz Foundation.
I love that guy. And he did a great service to this country twice, once for serving and then for keeping this guy out of the White House.
You remember that debate he had that's on tape with Kerry?
Oh, from their youth or relative youth. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. And he just destroyed him. And he was a Swift boater himself, but he was a real Swift boater. Remember?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were upset in part that, one of Kerry's, it sounds like a joke, but one of his three Purple Hearts was a beer can cut, opening a can of beer.
He got hit in the rear end.
Well, that was maybe number two, literally.
But I remember that so well. That was the big 2004 campaign.
Right.
And they've created a verb about it. Remember, it was called swift boating.
Right.
And the thing was, he made all of these statements, and then John O'Neill and the so-called swift boaters all challenged them, and then they produced all the data. And it was kind of like the Dan Rather effort.
Right.
It was false but accurate. False in the meaning we made it up, but accurate in the idea that it should be true because we are better people than they are. Dan Rather, right. By the way, the other day brought that back up. He's back in the news again, and he's about Trump.
So, this is part of the lack of shame in our society, that this clown Rather was so a liar, a conveyor of the news who blatantly lied and contrived evidence that, thank God, the good people at Powerline exposed. That was brilliant what they did. But how does he have cachet still to have the gall to appear in public and opine on anything is beyond me.
Well, I don't know. I think John O'Neill is still active, isn't he? I'm pretty sure.
It's been a while. He's a lawyer. He was a lawyer. Maybe he's retired now down in Texas. But he came on, actually was a guest once on a National Review cruise, and just an awfully, awfully nice guy.
And he was not some right-wing guy. I remember
that. No, he was not.
He voted for, I think, Ross Perot or Al Gore or something. He told me that. He was not
right-wing. He's not a right-winger, no. Hey, Victor, our God-given freedoms are facing unrelenting attacks. It's a battle for truth, and the only way we win is if we stand together. Thankfully, Alliance Defending Freedom has been defending our rights for 30 years and winning. Right now, they're involved in two critical cases before the Supreme Court. In the first one, they're suing the FDA for endangering the health and safety of women and girls. And in the second case, they're assisting the state of Idaho to defend its law protecting the lives of women and their unborn children against the Biden administration's attempt to override the law and force doctors to perform abortions. You heard that right, folks. Force doctors to perform abortions. They need your help. With your best gift, you courageously join ADF in fighting critical Supreme Court cases against government lawlessness and help defend our cherished freedoms. Go to joinadf.org/Victor. That's joinadf.org/Victor to give now. With your help, I've pledged to raise $5,000 by March 31st for ADF. So please, folks, visit joinadf.org/Victor to make your best gift right now. I know with your help, we can beat that goal and help make a generational difference for freedom. And we thank the Alliance Defending Freedom, truly one of the great organizations in America. We thank them for sponsoring the Victor Davis Hanson Show. So, Victor, we've got John Kerry knocked off the list. We have a little time, hopefully, for two more topics. One of them is Sweden. I think you've heard of the place, Electrolux, Volvos, and whatever the heck, crackers, as we've talked about in the past, your great Swedish ancestors. But Sweden is now, the country is now a member of NATO. And it's the vote happened, so it's formally in a member of NATO. What are your thoughts about that, Victor? Is it a good thing, bad thing, consequential, anything about their NATO membership worrying you?
Well, I think people should realize that given our ancestors' relatively recent 19th century Vietnam era reputation for pacifism, it had a stunning military tradition. I'm not just talking about the Vikings, you know, Gustavus Adolphus and he was king of Sweden for 20 years. He was one of the most renowned warriors in Europe. And then there was Charles the XII, who invaded Russia. He ended up like Napoleon almost. But so it's a warlike country. And I know in World War II, somebody go, nah, Victor, you better stop it. You better stop right there. They sent iron ore and paid the transportation fees to Hitler. Well, yes, they did. That's a little blemish, but they were very good on the lockdown. But the other thing is they make wonderful weapons, if I can use wonderful in the context of weapons, Saab fighters and they've always been, they're kind of like Switzerland, but they're a little, they're politically neutral. They try to be, but they're also military neutral. But when you put Finland and Sweden into NATO, that's not like putting, I don't want to be too cruel, but that's not like putting Belgium and Holland.
Spain.
Is not Spain and Portugal. Right. You're talking about two frontline states that have to deal with Russian overflights and Russian violation of territorial waters all the time. And they have a long history of dealing with the Russians. And Finland was invaded in November 1939. And although they lost that war, they were able to get pretty good concessions, and they inflicted over 500,000 casualties on the Red Army. They fought brilliantly under Mannerheim. And Sweden and Finland then are two highly capable, very well armed to the teeth, successful societies on NATO's northern flank. So they're not a vulnerability, they're an asset. And I think everybody, so there is truth when the supporters of the Ukraine war said it. I think the critics said, well, it's weak in NATO. And the supporters said, no, it's made it stronger because they're spending more. No, it's half and half. It's made it stronger by getting some really good countries like Finland and Sweden right on their front rank. But when you look at the attitude of Turkey, it has the largest army in NATO or the United States, it's now just overtly on the side of Russia and Iran. And it's also made it very clear that a lot of states in NATO did not live up to their 2% GDP expenditures on, and they're not going to, and they're not helping Ukraine in a way that you would think they would as members.
Right.
And so I don't, it's a mixed bag. NATO is both stronger and weaker. But if Putin decides that he wants to punish NATO by going into the Baltic countries, I think Finland and Poland and Sweden would fight. I do not think that Belgium or Luxembourg or Holland or Italy or Spain or Portugal would send troops all the way over to Latvia or Estonia. I just don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah. You said, kind of related off that, Victor, I didn't mean to bring this up, but Macron talked about sending French troops to Ukraine now.
He did.
Yeah. Any thoughts on that?
It was kind of like a threat. Either give us a lot of money for Ukraine or you'll end up fighting. And then we had a terrible security lapse with Germany that let Russia know about some of its inner workings about supplying Ukraine. And I think I got a good idea where America, I wrote a column about Ukraine, and you know, it's up to Verdun levels now from February to December of 1916, 108 years ago, they lost 700,000 people. August, the list, we were told in August, Russian and Ukrainian dead and wounded were 600,000. So 5 months later, at the ratio they gained to that, there might be 800,000. And nobody seems to talk about that. Everybody says the spring offensive, you know, there was no spring offensive. It tried. Why a country that lost a quarter of its population was trying to break through into Russia through that Maginot Line, I just don't understand why they did. They should have had the Maginot Line, and they should have let the Russians butt against them. In fact, that's what they're doing now. They're digging. But I don't know what the strategy is. Is it 1 million? Is it 2 million? Is it 3 million before there's some type of deal?
Right.
Or do you think you're going to take this shattered Ukrainian army and give it all these sophisticated weapons, and it's going to go push Putin out of Crimea and Donbass, which no previous president said that was on our agenda, and then we're going to win, and he's going to concede? And all these threats they make every day about tactical nuclear weapons are always going to be a threat? I don't know the answer to that, but people have a high degree of certainty that they do, and yet I don't think their record shows that they're right.
Right. Yeah.
And I say that as somebody who's happy to give Ukraine the weapons to protect itself as it tries to find a diplomatic solution by rebuilding its deterrence.
Well, for our listeners, I'll get the pitch in now. Victor's website, The Blade of Perseus, victorhansen.com. Victor's article that he was just mentioning, the Ukrainian Verdun, is there, and you can read it there, along with his links to his previous essays for American Greatness and syndicated columns. And you should subscribe. It costs you $5 to get in the door, $50 for the full year, and that's to read the ultra articles that Victor has written, 2 or 3 a week. He's got a series up right now called The Mythologies of the Middle East. You'll want to read it. You'll need to subscribe in order to do that. There's a ton of Victor content there. So go to The Blade of Perseus, victorhansen.com. So Victor, we've got one more topic to talk about, and that is the new issue of Strategica. That is the online journal that you oversee and stage manage at the Hoover Institution. And the current issue, number 90, is about Iran and its proxies. And we will get your thoughts on this right after these final messages.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and 3-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We are back with the Victor Davis Hansen Show. So, Victor, Strategica number 90 has three pieces: Edward Luttwak, Jerry Hendricks, and my, I love Bing West so much. I just want to read this quick one little thing at the end of Luttwak's piece, which was the lead piece. And these pieces are about Iran and deterring Iran and its proxies. But he writes, the principle involved is that remember, we had three Americans killed recently, and we were going to show payback Iran for what they did. It killed our soldiers. Luttwak writes, the principle involved is that if deterrence fails, it can only be restored, if at all, by deliberately disproportionate retaliation, not by expensively sending precision weapons halfway around the world to attack empty buildings. So, Victor, an important lead essay, other important pieces here in Strategica. You are the master of it. Please tell us anything you want about this new
issue. We usually have disagreement in our issues by choice. I try to get a historical backgrounder and then two opposing views. But on this particular question of Iran, it was very hard to find one of our 40 members that would write that the Biden policy is correct. So I don't know what they're going to write until they write it, our contributors, but they're all similar. They all say that there is no deterrence and Iran is acting as the arbiter of Middle Eastern affairs. They caused the Hamas war. They're responsible for Hezbollah shelling Israel. They're responsible for the Houthis basically shutting down the Red Sea. They will continue to do that. They feel that as a Persian power, they sort of like using non-Persian Arab surrogates that may be Shia, such as Hezbollah or Hamas or the Houthis, to do their dirty work. And then they wink and nod. They may not have the bomb, so they feel they're sacrosanct from actual attacks. A couple of the essays at places say it is a mistake when you're confronted with this horrific octopus to keep trying to slice off an inch or two of their tentacles each time. It doesn't lead anywhere. So the Houthis sink a ship. They kill some Americans. We take a little chopping block and take off one tentacle about 6 inches. And so what they're advocating is you go to the head of the octopus and you put a dagger in his eye, and that will get their attention. And I think we're getting close to that. I think also when you start to read these stories, they're having elections in Iran this week, and or they had them, excuse me. And there were, even the theocracy admitted that in some of these large cities, there were only 7 or 8% turned out. So nobody is voting, and they're sick of the regime. Maybe that's a consideration why we don't reply in a muscular fashion, but it might even hasten their end if you were to take out their military assets on Iranian soil for what they've been doing without injuring civilian population to humiliate them. But they know what's coming. They think that Joe Biden has given them a window of opportunity. They think they've got essentially 10 months more to do what they're doing, to destroy the Israeli border with Lebanon and turn it over more and more to Hezbollah, and to make such an open sore in Gaza. The Israelis are tied down, and then to encourage the Houthis to cause trouble and shell southern Israeli cities. They think that's all great, and there's going to be no retaliation. But they do think that if Biden loses in January, there'll be a lot of retaliation.
Yeah.
There's some criticism. I did a Goodfellas interview with John Cochran and H.R. McMaster, colleagues at the Hoover Institution. It's available now, called Goodfellas. Bill Whalen.
It's on Ricochet, right?
Yeah, it is. Bill Whalen's a great, great moderator. Neil Ferguson was not present this particular. He's one of the three. But I had an exchange with H.R. McMaster, and we were in large agreement about the success of the Trump administration. But he made the argument that Trump did not go far enough, that when some of our installations were hit after we bombed the crap out of ISIS or destroyed the Wagner group, especially after we killed Soleimani, Trump did not act forcefully enough. He granted that they had acted very forcefully. But when you have criticism of Trump from the right and saying that Trump could have done more, you get the idea that they're going to do more when he comes back into, if he's elected president. And I think as soon as he's elected, you will not see one, not one Houthi attack on an American ship, not one. I really believe that. And I think Hezbollah will start tapering off the missile attacks. Because I think what he's going to do is he's going to go over to Netanyahu and he's going to say, what do you need? Okay, handle it. And then he's going to go to the Gulf states. Let's get back to the Abraham Accords. Iran's a problem. I will do what you need to do with Iran. And then maybe there'll be, who knows what will happen inside Iran. But Iran should know that if Joe Biden is not elected, the days of its killing and freelancing terrorists are going to be over.
Oremus, let us pray. Well, Victor, we've come to the end of this episode, almost. We thank our listeners for listening, no matter what platform they do that on. Those who do it on iTunes / Apple can rate the show 0 to 5 stars. The rating average for several thousand folks who've done that is 4.9 plus. A couple people don't give it 5 stars, Victor, but that's because of the annoying host of the show. But some people leave comments. We read them. We read them here on Apple. We read them also on your website, Victor. And here's one. It's titled NPR. I really had to laugh the other morning when Victor did his NPR voice. He really nailed it. I thought I was the only one who was irritated by that subliminal hypnotist, communist propagandizing voice. You're getting sleepy. When I say idiot, you will go vote twice and riot in the streets. This only works on uninformed, lazy, irresponsible, mind-numb leftists. Thank you for wonderful podcasts. Hopefully, people that are in need are finding it. God bless you all. All the best. Hanging on by a thread in San Diego. And it's signed Bob NNNN. So thanks, Bob. And thank you, Victor, for all the wisdom you shared today. Folks, if you're interested in what I do, Jack Fowler, I write Civil Thoughts, the free weekly email newsletter for the Center for Civil Society at AMFIL. It's, as I'm repeating myself, free. We're not selling the lists. So go sign up, civilthoughts.com. Every Friday in your inbox will be a collection of 14, here's 14 recommended readings, great pieces I've come across in the previous week, a link and an excerpt. I know folks are enjoying it. I thank the many who've written me saying they do so. So go there. Also, a few other notes. If you're on Twitter, Victor writes once or twice a week now also for Twitter and, you know, column length. Are they rants, Victor? I don't know. They're pretty wise.
No.
His handle is gone. No, they're not rants. They should be syndicated in their own right, frankly. It's typically great stuff.
As NPR would say, Jack. No, okay. Jack. They're not rants. They're really not rants. They're very, very sophisticated exegesis of contemporary problems here at the Victor Hansen website.
Okay.
I think you should know that. And they're not emotional. They're sober and judicious. And they reflect a point of view that we don't often hear.
What is the plural of exegesis, by the way? Is it exegesi or is it exegesis?
It's a third declension Greek noun. So it's like polis, city state. So it's EIS in Greek. So in English, it would be ES.
Okay. Appreciate that. My favorite classicist. Well, at VD Hansen, that's his handle. On Facebook, there's a terrific group, the Victor Davis Hansen Fan Club, run by great people, Joe and Allison. Check that out. Victor's VDH's Morning Cup. You'll also find that on Facebook. So, okay, folks, you heard enough of me. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Victor Davis Hansen Show. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for listening.